Welcome back. It is literally February. Like, what the fuck?
I don't know how we got here.
Last week, we asked you guys on our Spotify poll if we should continue our true crime series, and you answered yes. So, prepare yourself for this week's Killer Couples. And if you haven't listened to our third episode of this series, it's available on Spotify and Apple as we speak. But as usual, go grab yourself a drink, a snack, get comfortable, and let's get into it. All right.
Before we get started, I want to discuss something that seems to be a common denominator in the cases we've discussed this series and even some of the last true crime series. Severe prolonged childhood trauma is a common theme in the backstories of many notorious serial killers. In fact, a 2005 study in the Journal of Police and Criminal Psychology revealed that prevalence of childhood sexual abuse among serial killers was 26%, while 36% had experienced physical abuse and 50% had been psychologically abused as children. So how can these kinds of adverse childhood experiences contribute to serial killers' patterns of violence? What we generally see when we have some kind of abuse is that victims begin to develop different thinking patterns than someone who has not been abused. The environment that we grow up in, we believe is normal. That becomes the way we relate to other people, the way we believe we should parent, and that tends to be your go-to for relationships, friendships, and even families. Without being taught something else, that's why they tend to repeat the cycle. For example, kids and parents in child protective services due to sexual abuse. Once it happens, it's difficult to keep it from happening again because they believe that's how you show love and that's how you interact with others and how family members treat each other, which is really sad if you think about it. They're getting the message, this is how we love each other. This is how we communicate and this is how we have relationships. This is how our family does things. And that's what they believe because the one abusing them is often their parent or their guardian, maybe the person they look up to, and that becomes a thought pattern which affects their worldview and how they behave as adults. So, that leads us to the next question. Do all or majority of the people who are abused as children become serial killers? The answer is no. Most don't even become violent, much less become serial killers. But what are some factors that lead a survivor of child abuse to develop an extremely violent response like serial rape or murder? The answer runs the whole gamut, right? So some of it is intellect. To be able to cover up your victims and carry out crimes over and over and over, you likely have to have some type of intellect, right? They have to be crafty enough to establish a pattern. It could even be them having little to no supervision. Either they had a single parent working two and three jobs, or parents who were addicted to drugs and didn't really pay attention to them, or some kind of other abandonment or neglect on top of the abuse. They had time to craft out how they wanted to do things. We see this cycle of violence happen all the time, but to a lesser extent. Say you're abused as a child. You grow up and you beat your partner, and eventually you're teaching your own children to do the same thing. And again, it's important to note there are plenty of people who are severely abused as a child who grow up and who are not violent at all, or who learn from their parents' mistakes. We tend to miss that a lot when we're talking about domestic violence. Because these cases we see on TV or see in the news become a media frenzy and they become our poster child for criminal behavior and what causes it. So, we wanted to bring up these facts simply because we did tell you guys last week that we were going to come up with a challenge for ourselves for this episode. Well, after a little bit of research, actually a whole lot of research, we weren't able to complete the challenge yet. Our goal was to find both killer couples where the offenders experienced limited or no abuse at all during their childhood. But unfortunately, it's sad to say that we could not find a single couple where at least one of them, if not both participants, experienced some form of child abuse or trauma. We thought this was important to note before we got into this week's case. Okay, let's dive in to Alton Coleman and Deborah Brown. Alton Coleman and Deborah Denise Brown were a couple of spree killers who embarked on an interstate string of heinous crimes across the Midwestern U.S. in June of 1984. So let's start with Alton. Alton Coleman was born on November 6th, 1955 in Waukegan, Illinois. He was the third of five siblings, and his mother, a prostitute, worked three jobs and allegedly threw him in a trash can when he was an infant, and he was retrieved by his grandmother. According to Robert Evans, a minister who knew him from birth, Alton was raised in a bad environment marked by rejection, drugs, prostitution, and sexual abuse. He was reportedly involved in group sex and bestiality with both his mother and grandmother, the latter of whom also made him kill and dismember animals as a part of voodoo practices. He was a middle school dropout, and Alton was also well known to Illinois' law enforcement, having been charged with sex crimes six times between 1973 and 1983. On December 27th, 1973, at just 18 years old, Alton Coleman committed his first known sexual offense. He and an accomplice abducted 54-year-old Eleanor McIntyre at gunpoint, raped her, and stole her money and her car. Through plea negotiations, Alton was convicted of armed robbery only and spent time in prison. Paroled out in late 1976, he was again put on trial for raping 17-year-old Sherry Patterson, but was acquitted when he managed to convince the jury that the act was consensual. While in pretrial detention at Lake County Jail, he was charged again with sexually assaulting three fellow male prisoners, but he was only convicted of battery. In 1980, he was again acquitted on charges of raping 22-year-old Dorothy Hawkins, a member of the U.S. Navy. In 1981, he was involved in the sexual assault of an underage girl. The case against him was dismissed for lack of probable cause. In July 1983, he was charged with twice molesting his own 8-year-old niece, Melinda Snow, by her mother, which is his aunt, and Alton's half-sister. Again, the case was dismissed, this time because of insufficient evidence.
Okay, can I just say this? How many times does someone have to be accused before we start believing?
It's a pattern, people.
Wow.
He's a rapist. On February 28, 1984, in North Chicago, Alton raped at knife point 14-year-old Shalandra Thompson, whose mother he had approached just 2 days before. He was arrested for this crime and arraigned on May 30th, shortly before embarking on the crime spree with his girlfriend, Deborah Brown. So let's get to Deborah. There's not much on Deborah. There's a lot more on Alton, which you'll see why eventually. But Deborah Brown was born in 1962, also in Waukegan, Illinois. She was one of 11 children. As opposed to Alton, she was from a somewhat stable background and had no prior criminal record when she first met Alton in 1983. She was engaged to another man, however, when she met him. Eventually, she decided to leave her fiancé and her family to move in with Alton and provide home care to his grandmother. Deborah was borderline intellectually disabled, suffered head trauma as a child, it does not say how she suffered this trauma though, and was diagnosed with dependent personality disorder by a psychiatrist. Although a willing participant in Alton's assaults and murders, Deborah had no history of violence or criminal history prior to their relationship, as we said just a second ago. Let's get to the spree. Wisconsin and Illinois. On May 29th, 1984, Alton and Deborah committed their first murder together. Going by the alias Robert Knight, Alton approached Juanita Wheat in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and befriended her. He then abducted Vernita Wheat and took her to Waukegan the same day. Vernita was Juanita's daughter. On May 31st, Alton befriended Robert Carpenter in Waukegan and spent the night at his home. The next day, he borrowed Robert's car to go to the store, but never returned. Vernita's badly decomposed body was later found on June 19th in an abandoned building just 4 blocks from Alton's grandmother's apartment. It was determined that she had been raped and the cause of death was ligature strangulation. Up next, we have Indiana and Michigan. This is a multi-state spree, by the way. June 18, 1984. Alton and Deborah are in Gary, Indiana, and encounter two young girls, 9-year-old Annie Hilliard and 7-year-old Tamika Turks. Using a ruse, the girls were brought to a secluded wooded area and tied up. When Tamika started crying, she was brutally stomped by Alton and carried away and left for dead. Annie was then forced to perform oral sex on both Alton and Deborah, and then raped by both. When the couple heard Tamika moaning from the woods where they left her for dead, they went and strangled her with a belt. They attempted to then do the same thing to Annie, but she miraculously survived and was found by a passerby. Tamika's partially decomposed body was discovered on June 19th, the same day that Vernita's body was also found, and the same day Donna Williams, a 25-year-old woman, disappeared. Posing as a couple named Phil and Pam from Boston, Alton and Deborah befriended Donna Williams. That evening, Donna was reported missing, last seen leaving the church to pick up her new friends, Phil and Pam. On June 26th, Donna's car was found in Detroit, Michigan, containing Alton's fingerprints and a fake ID belonging to Deborah. On July 11th, Donna's decomposed body was discovered about half a mile from where her car was found. She had been raped and killed by ligature strangulation. On June 24th, the duo kidnapped at knife point a 28-year-old Detroit woman in front of her home and demanded to be driven to Ohio. The hostage intentionally crashed her car into a parked truck and ran away.
Good for you, girl.
4 days later, on June 28th, Alton and Deborah invaded the residence of Palmer and Marge Jones in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. The Jones were badly beaten, robbed, and their car was stolen. On July 2nd, the couple entered the Detroit home of 55-year-old Marion Gaston, the companion of a woman they had befriended just earlier named Mary Billups, also 55. Both Gaston and Billups were tied up, gagged, and beaten with a wrench. Marion's car was stolen by Alton and Deborah, who then took it to Ohio themselves. So now they're in Ohio. It's July 5th. Alton and Deborah arrived in Toledo, where Alton befriended a single mother named Virginia Temple. She had 5 young children. When Virginia stopped communicating with her relatives, authorities were notified and entered her home, where they found 4 of her children alone and frightened. During the night or early morning of July 7th, the two forced Virginia and her oldest daughter, Rochelle, in the basement, where they beat and strangled them, then placed their bodies inside a crawl space of the home. It could not be determined whether or not Virginia was sexually assaulted, but Rochelle definitely was, as she was found bleeding from her private parts. The house was also robbed of clothing and jewelry. That same morning as the Temple murders, Alton and Deborah entered the home of Frank and Dorothy Dovendak, 73 and 77. They were bound with electrical cords and gagged them with paper tissues. The couple stole the Dovendaks' money and their car. So they're just changing cars at this point. Money, clothes, whatever. Later that same day, Alton and Deborah visited the Dayton, Ohio home of Reverend Milliard Gay and his wife, Catherine. The two stayed with the Gays and accompanied them to a religious service on July 9th, where the next day the Gays dropped the couple off in downtown Cincinnati. After the July 11th discovery of Donna Williams' body back in Detroit, Alton was placed 11th, which is a rare occurrence, on the FBI's most wanted list. Alton Coleman was the 10th person in history since the initiation of the list in 1950 to merit this type of inclusion. So traditionally they do top 10. Mm-hmm. They felt the need to do top 11.
Wow.
He was that bad. On July 12th, Tony Story, a 15-year-old girl who lived in Cincinnati, was reported missing by her parents. She was last seen the day before in the company of an African-American male and female. The male was later identified by a witness as Alton Coleman. 7 days later, on July 19th, her badly decomposed body was discovered in a vacant apartment building. She had been strangled, and while the state of her body once again did not make it possible to know whether the victim was raped or not, forensic evidence, along with a bracelet belonging to the late Virginia Temple, pointed to Alton and Deborah. Alton and Deborah then bicycled into a Norwood neighborhood on July 13th at 9:30 a.m. Less than 3 hours later, they drove away in a car belonging to Harry Walters, who they left unconscious, and his wife Marlene, who was raped and beaten to death. Harry Walters survived and later testified that they had met the couple to discuss the potential purchase of their camper, but then Alton attacked him with a wooden candlestick. The coroner indicated that Marlene had been bludgeoned approximately 20 to 25 times during her violent assault. Shards of a broken soda bottle, which had Alton's fingerprints, were found in the living room, and bloody footprints made by the 2 different pairs of shoes were found in the basement. The Walters' red Plymouth Reliant, as well as money, jewelry, and shoes, were also stolen. 2 bicycles and other clothes and shoes not belonging to the Walters had also been left behind. So at this point, they're leaving their stuff and getting new stuff.
Yeah.
2 days later, the Plymouth Reliant of the Walters was found abandoned in Kentucky, where Deborah and Alton, along with an accomplice named Thomas Harris, abducted 33-year-old Olin Carmichael Jr. from Lexington, Kentucky. Olin was a college professor from Williamsburg. Deborah and Alton drove back to Ohio with Carmichael locked in the trunk. The three placed a phone call to Carmichael's wife demanding ransom. They never showed up to pick up the money at the agreed location, and Olin was eventually found on July 17th, still alive, in the trunk of his own car, which the couple had abandoned in Dayton, Ohio. Alton and Deborah returned to the home of the Gays. Reverend Gay, who at this time already recognized Alton as a wanted fugitive, asked, and I quote, "Why you want to do us like this?" In which Alton responded, "I'm not going to kill you, but we generally kill them wherever we go." End quote. The couple was then tied up, and an unsuccessful attempt was made to strangle Catherine. Before leaving with money and their car, Alton made one last attempt to kill Catherine by shooting her with his gun, but it malfunctioned. Clothing belonging to Virginia Temple was found on the scene. Alton and Deborah took the car and headed back to Illinois. Along the way, they stole another car in Indianapolis and murdered its owner, Eugene Scott. On July 19th, the lifeless body of Eugene Scott, who was 75 years old, was found in a ditch outside in Indianapolis. He had been shot and stabbed repeatedly, and Eugene's car was later found parked near the location where Alton and Deborah were later arrested. On July 20th, Alton and Deborah were arrested in Evanston. As they walked across an intersection, they passed in front of a motorist who was surprisingly from Alton's neighborhood back in Waukegan. The motorist drove north to a gas station and notified the police from a payphone. The couple was soon spotted sitting on portable bleachers in an empty Mason Park. As two police sergeants approached Alton, Deborah was observed walking away toward the rear of the park. Two other officers stopped her as she tried to exit. They searched her and found a gun in her purse. The pair were taken into custody without incident and transported to an Evanston police station where both were identified by their fingerprints as Alton Coleman and Deborah Brown. As Alton was strip searched, a steak knife was found between two pairs of sweat socks he was wearing. A week after their arrest, more than 50 law enforcement officials from six different jurisdictions met to plan their strategy for prosecuting the couple. Seeking the death penalty for the couple, Michigan was quickly ruled out because it did not employ capital punishment. It was decided to give Ohio the first attempt at sentencing, with U.S. Attorney Dan Webb stating this: "We are convinced that prosecution in Ohio can most quickly and most likely result in the swiftest imposition of the death penalty against Alton and Deborah." The state of Ohio convicted the couple, finding them guilty of rape and murder of Tony Story in Cincinnati and Marlene Walters in Norwood, but not for the murders of Virginia and Rochelle Temple in Toledo. Coleman and Brown were both sentenced to death in Ohio. Alton's case was sent to the U.S. Supreme Court several times between 1985 and 2002, but his numerous arguments that his conviction and death sentence were unconstitutional failed to sway the justices. However, his death sentence in relation to Tony's killing was overturned in a separate proceeding. Despite this, Alton's death sentence in relation to the Walters murders remained upheld. During the course of his Ohio and Illinois trials, Coleman acted as his own lawyer and got to the point of calling Deborah, who was separately tried, a rebuttal witness.
This makes me think of Ted Bundy.
He personally cross-examined her in an attempt to make it look like she had in fact murdered Marlene, not him. Needless to say that this strategy did not work. On her own part, Deborah received two death sentences in Ohio and Indiana for her role in the Walters and Turks murders. In 1989, her Ohio death sentence was commuted to life imprisonment by the governor, who was a known death penalty opponent due to her diagnosed mental retardation. In 1991, her Indiana sentence was similarly commuted to 60 years, which combined with the other sentences she received made 140 years of imprisonment. In addition to the death sentence, Alton and Coleman were each sentenced to 20 years in prison for transporting the kidnapping victim of Olin Carmichael across state lines. On April 25, 2002, the Ohio Supreme Court rejected a claim by Alton's attorney that the state's plan to accommodate the large number of victims and survivors who wanted to view the execution would turn it into a spectator sport. So many victims and survivors of Alton's crimes were allowed to witness the execution that prison officials had to set up a closed circuit viewing venue outside of the building. For his last meal, Alton ordered a well-done filet mignon smothered with mushrooms, fried chicken breast, a salad with French dressing, sweet potato pie topped with whipped cream, French fries, collard greens, onion rings, cornbread, broccoli, biscuits, and a cherry Coke.
That's a meal.
That is a meal. On April 26th, 2002, at 46 years old, Alton Coleman was executed by lethal injection in the death chamber at Southern Ohio Correctional Facility. His last words were Psalm 23. Coleman had received two death sentences from Ohio and one from each Illinois and Indiana. At the time of his execution, he was the only condemned person in the United States to have death sentences in three states. In prison, Alton was diagnosed with mixed personality disorder, displaying antisocial, narcissistic, and obsessive features, with additional diagnoses including epileptic spasms, psychosis, and borderline personality disorder. Deborah Brown was originally sentenced to be executed in Ohio for her complicity in these crimes. Had her death sentence commuted to life imprisonment by Ohio's governor, as we previously stated, in 1991. In commuting Brown's sentence, the governor cited her low IQ scores, ranging from 59 to 74, and her master-slave relationship with Alton Coleman influencing her actions. Deborah was one of eight Ohio death row inmates, including all four of the female death row inmates, to have her sentence commuted. The governor, as previously stated, was an opponent of capital punishment, and this was all done a week before he left office. She got lucky.
Mm-hmm.
Despite her nonviolent history prior to the spree, Deborah Brown was initially unrepentant for her acts. During the sentencing phase of her first Ohio trial, she sent a note to the judge which read, in part, "I killed the bitch, and I don't give a damn, and I had fun out of it." Sounds about right.
Master-slave relationship. I love how they always label that with men and women when clearly...
she knew what she was
this
doing.
This bitch fucked up, okay?
She was also given a death sentence for the murder of Tamika Turks in Indiana. However, that sentence was ultimately commuted to 140 years imprisonment in 2018. Brown is currently serving her sentence without possibility of parole at the Dayton Correctional Institution in Ohio. She finally expressed remorse for her crimes when she apologized to the victims' families in a 2005 video. Deborah was personally interviewed in prison by an FBI agent from a supportive unit, and he found her to be a very passive, compliant person who would be defined by whoever was influencing her. Her relationship with Alton Coleman was one of one slave to master, but on the other hand, she never displayed any evidence of conscience. And if again put under the influence of someone like Alton Coleman, Douglas thought that she would even resume where she left off. Deborah Brown was diagnosed as a borderline intellectually disabled with dependent personality disorder. And I have two interesting facts and I'll be done. First fact, at some point during the trial, it was discovered that the two used upwards of 17 known aliases during their spree.
Dang.
Interesting fact number two. Some authorities believed that Alton and Deborah, both African American, usually selected black victims because they knew that they would blend in better in the black community. Noting that their crimes lacked a racial motive, which if you don't watch any type of true crime documentary or Criminal Minds or whatever, typically when multiple victims of one race are murdered, they tend to label it as a hate crime almost or a racially motive crime. So that's where that's stemming from. However, a retired FBI profiler once stated that Alton Coleman, in the middle of a vicious sexual assault, went into, and I quote, "a practically incoherent rant about how black people were forcing him to rape and murder other black people," as if that could somehow explain and justify his actions. Alton and Deborah allegedly left a racist slogan written in lipstick at the scene of a murder and rape of Tony Story, which was only one of their victims who was not African American. So Tony Story and Marlene Walters and her husband, I believe, were the only two non-black victims. Everyone else was of color.
Wow.
Which is surprising, usually when you see
people
what we've seen. Right. And they didn't have an age. I mean, typically the ones they were raping were of young, like young children, but they were killing anybody.
Right.
Of all ages. So that is Alton Coleman and Deborah Brown.
We're back. Before I dive into mine, I just want to say how grossed out I am by yours. But also refer to exactly what we said. The women always get off death row. The men are put to death, and somehow the women are painted as these innocent master-slave dynamic victims. And I'm just not buying it, but who am I? Anyway, so this case that I'm going to tell you guys about is actually super unique. I had never heard of it before, and it is a case that came out of Russia, and it's not a very old case. So we're going to talk about the Gang of Amazons, is what the media calls them. So the Gang of Amazons is a family of serial killers from Stavropol, Russia, who committed a series of murders and robberies over a span of 6 years. Inessa, along with her husband Roman and two daughters Victoria and Anastasia, began their murder spree in 2007, but some accounts detail offenses as far back as 1998. Initially, the Gang of Amazons was believed to be called this due to the predominance of women over men that composed the group. However, it was discovered that the name actually came from journalists who covered the investigation of crimes committed by the family. So it's important to note that the family has never actually used this name when referencing themselves. The family was only named the Gang of Amazons after the media discovered that a knife engraved with "My Favorite Amazon" was found not too far from one of the crime scenes. The local media just assumed that this was Inessa's knife. However, according to the deputy head of investigation, the knife actually belonged to a girl who had no affiliation with the gang or their crimes. So they actually got their name from something that had no affiliation to them whatsoever. So let's just break down a little bit of who each member of the family is. So the Gang of Amazons was a family of four who lived in a comfortable home in Russia. The family used camping trips as a cover to commit their crimes. Roman, who was 35, was the patriarch of the family and was a registered dentist. He was also the suspect of the mysterious death of Inessa's first husband and later went on to marry her. Inessa, who was 46, was the matriarch of the family and also a nursery school teacher and homemaker, but gave up being a teacher for their robbery and murder business. She had a profound hatred for police after her lover, who was a policeman, left her for another woman. Victoria, who's their oldest daughter, she was 25, and this daughter was actually from Inessa's previous union with a man who died under mysterious circumstances at a power grid where he worked. Anastasia, who was only 13 years old when this happened, she was the youngest member of the family and a juvenile at the time of the murders. And then a member named Sergei, he was 35 and he was actually Roman's brother-in-law, and him and his wife are actually very significant later. But Sergei was a police officer that provided the inside information to the family to help them basically keep from getting caught with the police. So now we're going to go to the victims. On February 17th, 2008, they murdered Mikhail, who was head of Information Security Department of the State Drug Control Service, and they also murdered his wife. They were shot in their home and then finished off with knives. The family took a doublet, a jacket, and a television remote control from the victim's house. Next, on July 17th, 2008, the family shot a car in which Alexei Sasanov and Julia Vasilyeva were traveling. Alexei was killed and Julia was seriously wounded. The family stole a purse from them that contained a driver's license and a passport, but it did not say to which of the victims they stole. On July 8, 2009, the family overpowered and shot Lieutenant Colonel Dmitry Chudakov, his wife, and 7-year-old son with a Sega 410 semi-automatic shotgun while they were parked on the shoulder of the road. Their 11-year-old daughter, Veronica, was stabbed 37 times. After the family murdered the lieutenant's family, they proceeded to take a laptop, hair dryer, and a camera, but left all the gold jewelry untouched. This became the family's most high-profile case ever. There was a man that was mistakenly accused of and spent 2 years in jail for this crime. The only evidence against him were the results of the ballistic examination. The expert of the Ministry of Justice had stated that the murdered family, as well as three other people in the vicinity, were killed with that man's carbine. Later, it was shown that the findings of the examination were erroneous and he was released from jail. I feel so bad for people that get accused of these crimes. You know, it's awful. So then in 2010, the family partook in another murder and robbery involving two teenage girls, one of whom was supposedly Anessa's goddaughter. The family waited for the victims to return home, planning to take out the entire family, knowing that they had weapons and money. But when only the family's two daughters showed up, Roman and Anessa ambushed them. The girls were tortured and had their eyes gouged out before they were murdered. While Anessa admits to killing adults, she claims that she never killed children, stating, "My husband shot them." So now they go to another town where they end up committing a series of murders. So on March 10th, 2009, the family broke into a house and killed the two residents who lived there. They first shot them with the Sega carbine and then finished them off with a knife. The family took their passports, a laptop, a camera, women's boots, and a man's jacket. On September 19, 2012, the family killed 26-year-old Vladimir Mandrick and 22-year-old Vasily Kamprin, two employees of a private security company who responded to alarms going off at a local dental clinic. The family took the security guard's service weapons, which included an assault rifle and two pistols. On November 29, 2012, they broke into the home of resident and taxi driver Vadim Loshkov. The man attempted to pursue them but was killed using the gun stolen from the security guards previously. On March 16, 2013, the family killed car inspector Nikolay Kutsikin, who left his apartment after hearing his car alarm go off. After seeing suspicious people near his car, he attempted to detain them, but he was shot and killed. And then on April 8th, in 2013, the family shot at a car of grocery store employees responded to alarms that were set off at their store. The wounded driver survived. However, his partner Yuri died later on at the hospital. On April 24th, 2013, the family murdered 39-year-old police lieutenant Andrei Yurin, who was going out for a late-night drive. He was shot at point-blank range shortly after leaving his home. The family attempted to break into the house, but the door was locked, so the family left without taking anything, saving the lieutenant's wife and child from the same fate. So now to their capture and arrest. So this is the crime that got them caught. On September 8th, 2013, after shooting an unarmed couple, Roman and Victoria proceeded to rob the home of a former military officer, Rostov Oblast. After finding no money, they proceeded to steal candles and alcohol from the home, as well as drumsticks from the refrigerator. Both Roman and Victoria escaped by scooter, but were stopped shortly after by patrol officer Ivan Shakovoy. Instead of showing his documents, Roman pulled out his weapons and opened fire, killing Ivan. Officer Alexei Lagoda, who was only wounded, was able to radio for backup. Roman was killed shortly after backup arrived. Victoria made it out of the gunfight alive, but she was seriously wounded. And shortly after, Anessa and Anastasia were captured by police at a campsite where they were guarding a large amount of weapons, including 20 firearms, silencers, grenades, and ammunition. Items stolen from victims were also discovered at the campsite, assisting police in linking the family to dozens of murders. The family saw their crimes like a day at the office. Anessa, who also confessed to hating police, stated, "I am a gangster by nature." Arrested alongside the family were Roman's sister and her husband Sergei, the former policeman. It is suspected that the couple aided the family by providing them inside information about police operations and officer movements. While Roman's sister would openly admit to aiding and abetting the family in court, she would not admit to knowledge of the planning of the crimes. Her husband Sergei confessed that he felt pleased that his colleagues did not know who was committing the crimes, but that he did. The couple stored stolen goods in their home and occasionally took jewelry to a jeweler for sale or to be melted down into new jewelry. So together, the family murdered 30 people, and their killing spree lasted until their apprehension in 2013. The family received a sentence of about 21 years each for their crimes. 21 years each for murdering 30 people. And not only just murdering people, torturing them. So according to the investigators, Anessa seemed to take pride in her crimes and saw herself as an admirable hero. During the interrogation, she said that she killed the police officers from personal hatred and said it's a pity that they did not kill them very much. So they actually ended up killing 6 police officers total out of the 30 people. So yeah, that is the Gang of Amazons. Had never heard of them. And literally, this is all there is on them. Even though it's a newer case, I told Mackenzie, I think that there's only this little bit because it was a crime that happened in Russia. So we don't really know anything about their childhoods up until the point that they met. So pretty crazy story though. And remember, the husband did die. So it's the wife and the 2 daughters that got about 21 years each for what they did, which is nothing in the scheme of what you've done to people's families.
Right. That is all we have for this week's episode. Short and, well, Sam's was short, not so sweet. That, I'm a gangster by nature.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, homegirl. Whatever you say. If you guys enjoyed my case, both of our cases, Sam's case, not mine, it will not hurt my feelings. Let us know by clicking the link in our bio on our Instagram, co.signpodcast, and rating, reviewing, or sending us a voice message on our Anchor link. And let us know if you have any crazy killer couples, because you know we're on the hunt for couples that did not endure any type of trauma or abuse as a child. And as always, we will see you guys next week for another killer couple episode.
Bye!
Oh my god. Oh my god. Oh my god. Oh my god. Oh my god.